And CBI Akbar, I said I would make a comment on Akbar. So we have been expecting the power spectrum any day to do analysis of the final results. The experiment is over, but the analysis is still going on intensely. And that's an important thing because the error bars at the high L end of the microwave background are quite astounding. And so one wants to not make any false statements. I think Andrew Lang talked about BICEP. He probably didn't give you any results. If he did, I'd like to know. And Quad also has delivered some very interesting results. Both are South Pole based. I put where these different experiments are on the timeline in terms of location, because you see there's a certain commonality of locations. Either a long duration balloon experiment, typically occurring around Antarctica, but not always. The South Pole, of course, is a fairly ideal, relatively cool location for experiments to be done. The best place of all is L2, which is where WMAP resides and where the Planck satellite will reside. The launch of the Planck satellite is scheduled still officially for July 31st, 2008. It may slip by a bit, but it probably won't slip by very much at all. And so the other great thing about the Planck satellite is that they figured a faster way, believe it or not, to insert into L2, in which it only takes 2 months to get there, not six, which is what it took WMAP. This changes the orbit a little bit, but it's pretty exciting because the data, whether delay or not, the data is going to start flowing to be analyzed almost right away. So that's a very exciting thing coming on the horizon. Bart Netterfield talked about SPIDER, and this is near and dear to us. It's going to be a long-duration balloon experiment, and it's probably got the best prospect in the near term, if we do say so, to actually push down the R limit, if not measure it. The target value is about R of 0.01. I don't have to explain what R is because it's been an underlying theme of this conference. There are other experiments that will be doing polarization. You probably heard about those as well. EBEX is another long-duration balloon experiment, somewhat different angular scales than SPIDER, and CLOVER is going to be on Chile. There is also a great frontier, and QUIET is using different technology, but it will also be based in Chile. There is another frontier, and that other frontier is to really try and resolve the high resolution end of the microwave background, looking not just for the extreme tail, and Mark Halpern talked about, and Shubha Majumdar talked to you about the great results that one can get from clusters from using these sorts of surveys. But Lyman Page certainly has it in mind that the key result from ACT will be the extended baseline to go after NS. But that requires that you know everything about everything else in order to get the extreme damping tail of the microwave background. So ACT and SPT have somewhat the same scientific goals, and they're both really doing well. And this is 3,000 kilometers. This is about 1,000 kilometers. So they're going after the high L. I think I won't say anything more about this figure. I'm just going to explain what it was that caused me not to be here for the entire meeting. And that is Bond as an observer. So I just got back from Chile. Why are all of the many of the microwave background experiments, those that aren't at the South Pole, why are they based in Chile? The Atacama Desert is the driest desert in the world. And you operate from an extremely high height. I'm very pleased that I didn't have to do any extra oxygen intake, surviving very well. This is the Cosmic Background Imager 2. The Cosmic Background Imager 1, which is where we learned about the damping tail, and we learned about the apparent excess in the CMB power spectrum as you move to high L, which may or may not be due to the Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect. Those had smaller dishes, and one of the ideas was that we would increase the size of the dishes in order to increase the throughput coming from coming into the results in order to sharpen up what we could say about this excess at high L. Interferometers work by interfering, not surprisingly, and so they take signals from here, and they cross-correlate them. It's been very effective. It was also very effective for using polarization. These are using high electron mobility transistors as the operating mechanism, and it turns out that those, if properly configured, are absolutely brilliant for doing polarization. And so that's why, even with quad, the CBI results still remain among the best, probably the best, I think it is the best, for a polarization. That will not last long, and presumably the next quad announcement will be pretty astounding. So these are all of the things that have been or are going to the Atacama Plateau. And we are also involved in the ACT experiment, which Mark Halpern talked to you about. Here's a rather pretty picture of the enclosure for ACT. And there I am. It actually is pretty cold up there. This was done for the benefit of some of the other people to show that Canadians, it's a piece of cake. So I shed my stuff, which is off the side here, and pretended like it was just balmy. This is the primary mirror for ACT, and it has all of these panels. And one of the remarkable things that was just accomplished is that they had to align all of the panels perfectly to get a really good surface, and that has been done. And so things are happening. And my good friend Lyman Page is about to spend his 50th birthday on September 24th in Chile, celebrating the birthday by working on ACT, which is one of the babies that they deal with. Okay, now to the subject of the talk. So it's going to be a little more theoretical than that experimental side, but the experiments are really, and where they are now and where they're going to is really the underlying theme. There'll be quite a bit of overlap with what you've heard, but maybe with a slightly different spin. Some of the things we do have some similarity to what Richard does, and sometimes we agree. As he said, probably more than 50. No, we agree most of the time. Okay, so these are the various probes. We've talked about that. The B-mode from tensors, there's this vast array of experiments that are at least capable of pushing down the limit, if not detecting it. And maybe in some distant future there might be a B-pole. It was often called CMB-pole, but you may know that the Beyond Einstein recommendations have come out, and they said the highest priority goes to LISA and to JDEM. And so they recommend that one keep planning for a B-pole, but it's not going to be. The Europeans, on the other hand, might end up going for a B-pole, and we're engaged in some interaction on that. Also, in results, I'm going to show you all of the latest other data, as well as CMB data, is being used, in particular the weak lensing release of April 07, the CFHTLS supernova 192 in that sample right now. Okay, so in dealing with inflation, there's the standard method, and we're going to talk about that. But there is really a method which we think is the correct way to look at the problem, which is in terms of dynamical trajectories that are driving the inflationary expansion. And so that's encoded in the deceleration parameter Q as a function of A. But the great thing about inflation then is that there is an intimate relationship between dynamics and resolution, resolution being related to the comoving wave number K, so that there is a relationship of K to A through the Hubble parameter times A, that is a very good one with quite a bit of accuracy. Of course, it's not perfect, but it's good enough to do constraints. What it means is because you're going after power spectrum, and let's think about the L range for the microwave background, you get to probe about 10 good E-folds in terms of where the data is good, where you don't get completely obscured by astrophysical phenomena. That goes from about 10 to the minus 4 megaparsecs inverse down to about 1 megaparsec inverse, which is where large-scale structure is probing. We saw results that really you don't want to maybe push too much beyond 0.1 megaparsecs inverse because you're going into the relatively large nonlinear, but calculations can at least somewhat deal with that. So there is no real relationship between this and this, but you can conceive of getting roughly 10 parameters to try and characterize that number of E-foldings, and so that's a possibility, as well as the usual canonical ones. And so we've been probing these issues and these trajectories. There is an intimate relationship between epsilon, as we've heard, and the tensor to scalar ratio R. And I'm going to give you the basic result of this so that I can skip over the 100,000 transparencies that I have as we move along. But the result is that epsilon now, as determined from the data, is very dependent upon the prior probabilities you assign to it. That shouldn't come as a big surprise, but it means that you have to bear this in mind, even in the lowest order considerations when people talk about what the current R limits are. What we find is that relatively large values of R are allowed if you assume a sort of an equal a priori probability hypothesis for epsilon. That is to say, can be fairly uniform, that the acceleration can be fairly uniform. But not surprisingly, if you adopt a logarithmic prior, it pushes your prior probability to try and go to lower values of R, and you're relying on the data to shove you into the a detection regime, if indeed there is a detection regime. And so what shouldn't surprise you is that the values come out to be quite low. Yeah.
And when you look at it in log epsilon, if you find that the potential electrical surface is relatively flat?
There's always a little bit of a peak to them, but there's actually quite a bit of a tail, which I'll comment on as we go as well. So in other words, it's trying to get towards this case. Okay, now as Richard has said, stringy theories are producing very low values of R. And an example is one that I'm going to show you, which we're pretty fond of, especially the name, roulette inflation, because it emphasizes the fundamental statistical nature of the way inflation models are operating these days. Statistical at every single level you can imagine, which makes them not as happy a kind of model where every theorist had a unique delta function telling them what their model was going to be and what the results would be. Of course, there was no overlap of those delta functions. But nonetheless, here, everything is totally statistical. there's quite a history of this very low R stuff. But then there's also another very general argument, which says that if for some reason or another, the inflaton field cannot exceed the Planck scale, then that enforces a limit where R is essentially less than, I really like the number that comes up when you do the simple analysis, 0.007.
This is a very serious bound. And nobody knows exactly why this should be a fundamental limit. And so I'm going to say a little bit more about this. But there's another aspect of inflation, which is inflation now. And so inflation now, which is dealing with the dark energy issue and what we can learn about it, actually it's paradoxical that something that's happening around us now, you can learn less about than something that happened in the first 10 to the minus 35 or so seconds of the expansion, because you can only look at it dynamically, because the waves are not kept like they are so that we can probe. They just run away because the masses are so small, so there is no clustering of the dark energy. And so all you get to do is to probe dynamics, but not resolution having much of an impact on the dynamics. And so the canonical W, we have come up with a formula that essentially fully paves with quite accuracy the whole plane of allowed W trajectories for quintessence style models that are not totally outrageous. Totally outrageous will become clearer as we go. And with that, we can then constrain some numbers of parameters. But you can't, because there's only about one good E folding, you don't get more than about two parameters beyond the omega lambda type number from the dynamics. And even the future is going to cause that problem for us. So with the current data now, a parameter epsilon s, which is essentially the square of the gradient of the potential, is being determined to fairly high accuracy. In this language, zero is the cosmological constant. Again, it's remarkable. It just happens to like this bang on. With Planck and JDEM supernova and Dune weak lensing, this will only be improved to about plus or minus 0.08. In other words, the improvements are important, but they aren't so dramatic as one might hope. And another parameter, which is determining the level of Hubble drag, which occurs for such an inflaton field, a quintessence field, it's essentially not determined now by the data, and it's only weakly determined in the future. So you don't get out very much from this tremendous expenditure. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. We should definitely do it, because it's the only way to find out about the dark energy. But nonetheless, the return is not like some full panoply of cosmological parameters like the microwave background has delivered. So now I'll expand on the then. And here I'm just going to pass through this with the speed of light here. These are the standard ways of doing business in the microwave background in terms of placing constraints, the usual cosmological parameters, spectral index for scalar and tensor, overall amplitude for scalar perturbations, and the tensor to scalar ratio R. That's the usual way of doing business. The 95% confidence limit with large-scale structure is about 0.28. But if you take that away, you get a somewhat large-scale structure, you get somewhat lesser value. OK, so this is blah, 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 blah. We know this all too well, right? Now, the other feature is DNS by DLON K, the running, which we heard a lot about, and I'm going to tell you a lot more about, but a different way of trying to think about it. What you would like to do if you're going to extend the running formalism is to go into more, I hate to say it, more parameters. And the way we do this is with the Chebyshev expansion of the scalar perturbation spectrum and the tensor, or scalar power spectrum, and the tensor power spectrum in terms of a Chebyshev expansion. So when you do that, at low order, you just have Chebyshev 1 is amplitude, Chebyshev 2 is amplitude plus tilt, Chebyshev 3 is amplitude plus tilt plus running, but you can go to higher order. As you go to higher order, for quite high order, Chebyshevs look quite like a Fourier expansion, which is one way to try and characterize a spectrum. Not the best, but it's one way to characterize it. An advantage of Chebyshev polynomials is that it's a polynomial thing that does the low order stuff that you're all used to, and yet it does go over into more of a Fourier thing. So you can actually do a fairly minimum number of parameters and still characterize complexity. Of course, you can do the same at whatever order you want with the tensors. You might say, is the data there to justify it? Will the data ever be there to justify it? Anyway, this is just a repeat. And so The standard 7 with the R is Chebyshev order 2 in this, Chebyshev 1 in the tensor spectrum. And one that's of some interest here is Chebyshev 3 to have running, but just a uniform tensor value. But we're going to go to higher order and see what it's like. All that being said, that's not the way we think the business should be done here. What you expect, almost generically out of inflation, is at the very least, PT, the tensor power spectrum, is monotonic. That is to say, it drops as K increases. So that's a very lowest order thing to require. So we do that with and without because, you know, you never know. It might not all hang together anyway. But better is to have a fully consistent relationship between the scalars and the tensors. And that means we go to this epsilon expansion, and we're doing Chebyshev. And the relationship of epsilon to the Hubble parameter and epsilon is essentially this. There are corrections. You try and take those corrections into account. But this is definitely the dominant kind of behavior, so that the scalars are controlled not just by the amplitude of H, but also by epsilon. So you make epsilon tiny. Therefore, you can make H small. That's the low-energy inflation story. And that story is the one that seems to be rather sadly emerging from the stringing community. And a measure of PT is a direct measure of the Hubble parameter. But even if you get this, there's a relationship. To get the Hubble parameter from epsilon is an integral. And in K-space, this is the integral. And so it means that there's an overall constant, which is the overall amplitude of this. If you get a trajectory epsilon of K and this pivot point, you automatically get the potential's trajectory. And it's a different language to think about. It's a trajectory. The trajectory can be considered as a function of K, as a function of ln A, or as a function of an inflaton field. For a single field inflaton model normalized to the Planck mass, this is a simple relationship between K, psi, and the square root of epsilon, which is 1 plus the deceleration parameter, also equal to this thing. It is why epsilon was used, by the way, just generally in the treatment for inflation now that I'll be showing. It's because it's essentially this kind of relationship that we are asymptotically going towards. Okay. You've probably seen the current run of the data. This is the most recent compilation. This is when we added the most recent ACBAR to the world, and then we reanalyzed everything. We made some modifications for WMAP3, which needed to be done. We use combined CBI data, which is not yet publicly available, we used SDSS and 2DF, and maybe we've heard a little bit about the discrepancies. The discrepancies are important, but not overwhelming for anything that I'm showing you. It's the usual sets of values that you get, so I won't go through those, but let's just remind ourselves of one of the big things that the WMAP team was touting. We actually had this earlier in our Boomerang 03 analysis results, which was the more than 2 sigma deviation from unity. But it depends what you actually throw into the mix there, exactly what that deviation is. Because if you just add tensors, this tends to move up somewhat. And if you add tensors in running, it actually moves down, but it depends upon the pivot point. That is to say, where you do the normalization, because NS is changing as a function of K. So the current limit is at 95% confidence is 0.28. That really depends upon having added the large scale structure. If you do running and tensor, the current limit is 0.36. And we find that to be quite robust. The running, as you've heard, is actually an issue. You know, we kept trying to say, two sigma effects. But you can see exactly where it comes from the data. And so that it's there should not be surprising. After all, there's low L stuff. that's dropping in the power spectrum. That's actually one of the big stories of the CMB, not the glitches, the drop. Yeah.
The quadrupole, you can sort of moderately lower.
Yeah, 2 and 3, it's and then a sort of flatness. So it's coming down. It's, it doesn't appear to have the land to rise, right? Okay, so the interesting thing is it's still an interesting kind of number with the running tensor, but there you've got a lot more freedom because you've got the extra parameter.
Dick, are you saying if the Lowell's rose as might have been expected?
Yeah, it would change things. So there are two things what you're doing, and it's the tendency, so you have to be really careful at the high LN with the data because you have to get the amplitudes absolutely accurately for the calibration for the high L experiments because you're always back ending. And then the low L's are always trying to push things down. So why it occurs is clear. And, you know, people were trying to say, we don't want to think about it, so and it doesn't fit models, so therefore we will always push ourselves to argue that it's a statistical fluke. Yes, it's not multiple sigma yet, but unless an error is found in WMAP, the tendency is not going to go away. Right, we have to live with the phenomenology of the low L in the microwave background unless a big error is found, and there sure has been an intense effort over many, many years.
Is that 0.6, minus 0.6 plus or minus 0.022, does that include or not include tensors?
This does not include tensors, and it...
Okay, that makes a lot more sense then.
And I might say that, you know, one of the things that you have to do is you have to actually try and marginalize over the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, which is building at the large scale power, because you know what you're doing with the tilt really depends upon what you've done at the high L end with other sources. Okay, so that's all taken into account, probably even correctly.
So you have independent parameters for tensors and scalars.
I'm going to take you on a much longer journey than that one, but yeah.
Okay, so, but of course, especially models are not independent, and you have a potential and the back potential fixed both of them.
Yeah, I'm going to show you that.
So that's going to narrow down.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you'll see that. Okay, I think people have sung the praises of the beam mode polarization, and that it's that low L is a tensor signal. It's obscured by a lensing signal that occurs at higher L. Some people say that's a joy, but from the point of view of trying to find evidence for primordial gravity waves, it is not. And probably Bart or somebody showed you this great thing, which is to show at R of 0.1 what happens to the polarization vectors if you add that amount of tensor. Okay, so you get small shifts. You see them? This is intensity in the background. This is about the sky coverage, 50% or so, that we should get from the long-duration flights of Spider. Okay, now.
How seriously should we take this 0.007?
What, as a limit?
Yeah.
It's probably much worse than that from the Stirling's point of view. The limit is a quote-unquote theoretical limit if a certain issue goes. And I'm going to get into that now. Okay, but just to remind you what it is that we're being challenged to do, you take that change, okay, and then you divide it by 10. And that's what we think we can get to with Spider. And we're serious people. Okay, so
serious people can be deluded.
not funding agents. So this is what we think we can do with a couple of years of Planck, a couple of channels, and 10 days of a long duration Spider using 2 channels. And that's the TT up top, you know, it's absolutely brilliant, and TE and TE, but this is the BB, and let me just remind you of the remarkable translation in that tiny little amount there. This is the thousands of microkelvin squared, and this is 0.02 microkelvin squared. And yet, in these bands, these are the sorts of error bars. If we understand systematics perfectly, which we just putting out a paper on astro pH, which says, oh yes. The real problem is the level at which we have to dig down into the foregrounds to deliver that kind of accuracy, which, depending upon where you look in the sky, might be a factor of 10, might be a factor of 40. That's why you need the multiple frequencies. But this is feasible. That's one configuration of spider. It keeps changing. It's thought about more. And this is Planck, which is, as I said, also able to do reasonably well on the tensors. Just to put this in perspective, and this was already put into perspective, but this is Latham Boyle's perspective. This is the sort of current limit from CMB plus LSS on omega gravity waves. And then if you want to do a direct detection, maybe a Big Bang observer in the second generation around the year 2030 might be able to penetrate into this regime. And there were some prejudices in making these bands of what the likely scenarios are for inflation, because there are whole classes of models where the numbers are way down here now, unfortunately. Okay, so this is a slide that my friend Lev Kaufman likes a lot, and I do too, especially the things in green, which we've worked quite a bit on, just the variety of models that are out there, and there are many, many more than this. Okay, so now, very quickly, I'm going to take you through the simple arguments, which I think you've heard enough here, but just to remind you of how robust the R results are. Here is just a power law potential. Things are put in terms of a reduced Planck mass, which is 1/8 g, with a phi squared, r is 0.13, a great spectral index. I'm sure that if the Mikhanov had said more than we're just going to have fun, he would have said this is what everybody should be targeting towards. The phi to the fourth is 0.26. with the slightly lower NS. And a theory which I am quite fond of, or had once upon a time, a pseudo-Nabu-Goldstone boson model in which the inflaton is essentially an angular direction. It relates the potential to a symmetry breaking scale, which is a reduced scale here. And epsilon is related to the number of equals to the end of inflation, as it was in these results too, essentially inverse there. Here, more importantly, it's exponential. So you could have exponential suppression of epsilon and a very, very tiny values. But if you want to match what the observations are showing for NS, roughly, then you end up with non-zero values for R, which are quite targetable for the experiments. To match 0.96, it's 0.032, and paradoxically, you make it even flatter, you get a somewhat larger R. So that's also quite within our grasp in terms of the errors that we think are achievable with experiments, and Planck could get to this too. Okay, but now I want to go to this argument, which is that the inflaton, whatever it is, should not exceed the Planck mass. In chaotic inflation, there was no problem with that. It was just an issue that was sort of a curious little fact on, but no more. In all of the models that people have constructed of stringy inflation, this is obeyed. And that is where the 0.007 comes from, if you just use that 50 factor and require it being less than. But I want to give an example of how much less than it can be. So we are typically getting values which are approximately less than about 10 minus 10 for this roulette inflation that I'll talk about, but we are the only ones. And the evolution of the inflaton field in n clock units is very tiny. And these are, of course, intimately related to each other. Whereas the evolution of the inflaton field in these reduced Planck units over the sort of 60 foldings or so that's needed to make these models work are sort of tens and more than tens. And so that's a real problem. This is a non-trivial problem. Those who are really fond of the n squared phi squareds, of which there are many aficionados out there because it just seems to be so simple and trivial, have to deal with this. And it may be that it isn't a fundamental issue, but it's not trivial. Okay, and then of course you all know how the energy scales are related here. The potential is 10 to the 16th joule to the fourth. If R is 0.1, so if you drop down to 10 to the minus 10, you drop V, but you've got a fourth factor, so that the V is actually scaled to be a few times 10 to the 13th. In other words, it's not inconceivable from the point of view of making such a low energy inflation. It is not a bad value. There is an argument, which I really don't have time to get into, that Renato Kalash and Andre Linde said, is that there's a strong reason that if the Hubble parameter is less than the gravitino mass, intimately related to this whole story, that it would have to be big if you had R being fairly large, and yet for other reasons, particle physicists prefer the TeV type scale. In other words, that's another argument which is being put in place to say within classes of models that are string related that you will end up with a small R. But this is by no means a complete story because there are so many possibilities. So I really don't have time to try and talk about large classes of models. Some involve the brains, anti-brains, and motion of the inflaton, which comes down here and then breaks in a hybrid fashion. That's the original KKL-MNT theory that got such press because it helped to sort of put things into, maybe for the first time, a realizable stringy model. It's just saying the same thing. Perpendicular directions on the flow of the inflaton are isocurvature modes. And what we have been interested in are large volume limits of the six-dimensional compactified manifold Calabi-Yau frame. And so there are scales. I'll show you a little cartoon that illustrates the idea better. But here, the main thing is that this is there's an angular variable and a radial variable. And so if you fall down this radial variable, that's one realization of inflation. But you can also zoom around an angle before you drop into the, guess what, the roulette spot, which is why we call it roulette. And so we find this to be a somewhat attractive model,
or at least not more unattractive than any other models. How many negatives can I make into a positive there? What is fundamental to these tails is, therefore, prior probabilities. The theoretical prior probability, which is then updated by the data in the classic fashion to tell you the posteriori probability. And so this thing is a fundamentally statistical quantity now in this game. And we've seen that that means that things will be dependent upon the nature of the prior assumptions that are made. I had already made the point that it used to be that these were delta functions. But now it's a probability distribution on a landscape. And that's the sort of emerging figure. And it's pretty difficult to see how one will slip out of it. So that there are lots and lots of parameters that go into such a thing, because you need to find the parameters as you are zooming down to some local minimum within the landscape, and they have a statistical distribution in any realization, so you don't know. This is an expansion of just to show how things are complicated. These are realizations of the Calabi-Yau manifolds. But the main thing I want to get to is, in these theories, the theoretical prior probabilities depend upon the probabilities of trajectories, because we're dealing with trajectories, But you deal with a trajectory for a given potential, that is to say, a given set of potential parameters. But then there's a probability of the potential parameters. And then there's the probability of the initial conditions that are defining the trajectory as well. In other words, statistics is fundamentally built into the problem. So the particular realization that's roulette inflation is to say that the volume, which is the KKLT breakthrough, the volume of the six-dimensional manifold that must be compact is stabilized. And yet there can be a lot of complex structure within that manifold, in particular holes. And our particular picture is that all of the holes are ultimately stabilized, and there's a last hole, or maybe a second from last hole, which has still got some dynamical settling down to do, and that's what the inflaton is. So it's a pretty amusing geometrical vision of this. It's the vision of Conlon and Cabeda and a number of other people, and the ingredient that we added to consider was that there is an angular counterpart. There is a lot of hubris in this subject because, for example, Conlon and company have said, within that kind of framework, here is this thing which is going to define where the quote-unquote standard model lies. In other words, trying to make quote-unquote predictions for the LHC. And that's a pretty exciting thing, and it's worthwhile to do because there's stuff to shoot down. Okay, so why roulette? So the inflaton is following a trajectory, and there are all sorts of possible trajectories that it can follow, and it can move over many minima before it comes down into the trough, which it ultimately does, and there can be quite complex behavior. So it's roulette because which minimum of the rolling ball depends upon the throw. But the roulette wheel we choose is also, because it changes the potential parameters, also a statistical concept. So anyway, the house being Einstein had another word for it, does not just play dice with the world, also plays roulette. Here is a simple example of the form of the potential. I'm not going to try and explain things very much. Tau is a radial variable. Theta is the angular variable. The critical thing to note is that exponentials are very important in this game. That's why all of the intuitions from the phi squareds, the phi to the fourth, et cetera, are not the things that are operating with these kinds of potentials. And exponentials are obviously things that you have to take seriously in any model, and in particular in this class. You can, from these trajectories, you can use the sort of h squared over epsilon kinds of formulas to estimate what the power spectrum is. So the power spectrum in scalar perturbations, you can't read the axes, that may be a very positive thing. This is the expansion factor logarithm of it. This is the power spectrum in scalar. There are a few decades on here. And this is the nature of those power spectra depending upon depending upon the specific trajectory. But here is the observable range. So yes, there's all sorts of shape. You might even call it pretty big running. But it's not when you just focus into an observable range. So one of these is the sort of standard tilt, and the other are the different realizations of it. And so it's actually not impossible to get results that fit. And we did, you know, a little bit of juggling to show that we could actually get things that work. Yeah? It's a pretty small running in this, by the way.
Where did you get, so you've got a minus 0.055?
That is the dotted line that was put in here.
Oh, I see. That's just to guide the
eye. Yeah, that's just to guide the eye. Right. So
in other words, the fact that those two things look different is important.
Yeah, no, that's quite an issue. Because as you know, most theories produce really small runs.
Right. I mean, you get running,
but
then it becomes a little,
it
becomes very broad.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, K, would you consider observable?
What?
How large a K do you consider observable?
Well, as I said, about 10 equal and 10 to the minus 4. But, I mean, yes, there are constraints that can come from, let's say, even you don't want primordial black hole creation of 0.01, et cetera. Right. But those are really sort of big, crude error bars. So that's not providing a really powerful constraint.
With respect to the calculation, you're using H squared over epsilon, right?
Yeah.
And you're just evaluating that at horizon crossing for each of the modes?
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons I would express concern about that is we've been doing a lot of work showing that if you're dominated by transient modes rather than the inflationary tractor, that formula doesn't work. You can't do that. And I'm wondering if you looked into that in this case, whether or not it's really self-consistent.
No, it's fine, except for, actually, it's not, the issue is not that form. It's how important the alternate perturbations are. So you're following a trajectory here, and so you get the sort of H squared over epsilon, which is following this thing. I mean, I agree that there are changes, but we've shown that over a very, you know, really kicking things, it's not bad. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's not bad, the H squared over epsilon. And then we do put in correction for them. So there's the small correction from the gamma, right? But
you're familiar with what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If you're not horizon crossing, you get a totally wrong answer if you're not in the inflationary tractor. I mean, not even close.
Yes, but here you're actually quite in the inflationary tractor. So here is the overall issue. I mean, you're completely in it. So there's a little bit of weirdness that can occur right at the beginning, but that, you're out in about an e-folders. Another important issue is, do you have enough e-folders? So some of these trajectories just don't have enough e-folders, so they are disallowed by the data. And the interesting question is, what kind of weirdness can occur from this kind of flanging thing here? Because we thought, well, you know, maybe no Gaussian, right? Maybe isocurvature. And that was my original reaction. You can get isocurvature, but you don't get, as far as I can tell, big non-Gaussian, basically because the amplitudes are pretty small. H is quite small. Yeah. So I don't think it's a really big deal.
This is a rather simple-minded question, but what you're doing is effectively stochastic theory. You've got probability distribution. So if you don't get if the probability distribution isn't peaked enough, you can't make a prediction.
You mean the prior theoretical probability? I'm not saying we are not making a prediction. We are making a statistical probability distribution. That is what the task of inflationists in a stringy world is. That is to say, you make a broad brushstroke prior theoretical probability, and then that's confronted with the data. And the problem is, it's a very wide thing. So within that probability, you could have a wide, wide range of NSs and probably even running indices, et cetera. And what you rely on is that it's the data that's going to tell you what is being allowed and what not allowed. So this is not a very positive thing. It's not like saying lambda 5 over 4 or n squared 5 squared has exactly this as the result. And you know, maybe with an n squared 5 squared, you can vary the m, but the trouble is the m is tuned by the amplitude. So you don't have very much freedom in those models, and it's not really a full blast statistical theory. Whereas here, you're confronted almost inevitably with a full blast statistical theory.
It is a classical theory. It's classical stochastic.
Yes, I know. So here is an issue, for example. How do you decide on the prior population of these initial conditions? So one thing that we thought is, because it turns out that in this really flat region here, before you start rolling down, that a stochastic kick takes you back here, equaling a roll down. So that's what's called the eternal inflation regime. And so there's a regime out here, as long as the corrections on the potential are huge, where you can get that kick. And so the original concept we had is that that is the most probable feeding into dropping down to the trough. That gives us well-defined, at least initial conditions, given potential parameters for moving in here. However, the trouble is, there are other collective coordinates on the manifold that may end up feeding this anywhere. And so the view that I am emerging on, partly because Moore is telling me this is the way to think about it, is that the holes are just able to oscillate all over the place in the original settling down of the manifold. And essentially what that means is that you're able to populate the trajectory, the initial conditions, in almost any way. I might also say that, you know, there are, in the first instance, you have to break the zero cost symmetry for these holes. And so that's why you end up with these potential structures. You've got instant fun and other types of effects if you're doing this. So that's why you get a potential structure of this form, which you believe is somewhat calculable, but you're always subject to people saying, yes, but have you taken all of the corrections into account? And nobody really can say, yes, I have, in any string inflation game. Is that correct, Mr. Myers? Please explain, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to spend much time on this stuff, partly because aspects, it's a different approach, but aspects have been treated by the flow, because we are not the greatest fans of the flow, because we think it limits initial conditions too much over the full class of possibilities. So I know you say you can open it up, but we have reproduced your opening up, and it's still pretty narrow relative to what we get with the Chebyshev expansion as a different way of dealing with the trajectory. So you are placing with the flow methods a prior probability of uncontrollable
okay.
Well, it's uncontrollable in the sense that you wonder why. You know, what could possibly do that? At least with what we're doing, you know, we passed away from the math inflation and those models, which are generically given really low R, trying to do the things as generally as possible. And we think that in the first instance, the most general is to say anything goes. And that's a uniform prior probability in these epsilon coefficients.
You're building the power spectrum and the Chebyshev polynomials, or you're building the inflation of the potential polynomials?
We're building epsilon of the Chebyshev. And actually, the way we're doing it now is 1 epsilon, and then adjusting the prior so that it becomes uniform.
We looked at around your eye and looked at the log, and looked at run chains.
With a log that what?
Around your eye, run chains, although we haven't published them. With log epsilon as the prior, we could, with the logarithmic prior epsilon, in other words, flat prior and log epsilon. And we saw once you got down below a certain cutoff point, then it seems that epsilon point is essentially irrelevant.
Right. I'm going to show you that first of all, that can't be correct. I mean, that is to say, the dynamics and the dynamics that's controlled.
We haven't published this yet, because we're still working it out. There was certainly an initial observation, so we get to do
that. Okay. So here, I sort of already talked about this. R minutes in the classic case, this is the scalar power spectrum, and these are one signal variations in the tensor power spectrum. In the thing that corresponds to the old way of doing business, which is constant R and uniform running index. So this is a language that you just have to get used to, is that this is the response. So this is the one signal variation in the band for the scalar spectrum. So, and then the tensors can be all over the place at this time of the limit, which is roughly the limit that you get. It's got a slightly different prior, but it's basically consistent with what one gets in the classical way of doing things. Now you go to one higher order, and it tilts down. And that's because it's got the freedom to be able to do a tilt. So this tilts And with our constant, it still tries to find an R. When you add more freedom, order 5, then the scalar spectrum is trying to tilt down. It's trying to tilt down slightly at both ends, from CMB data here, CMB data here, primarily. And then the tensors can be all over the place, but you blow away the limit because you don't have the direct connection
between the tensor scales, which are upping the power at low L, and the scales of large-scale structure, which is what you had to place the strongest limit that one had before. This is just a repeat of it, but it's to show you what happens if you do a logarithmic prior in the power spectra as opposed to a uniform prior in the power spectra coefficients. So with the uniform prior at order 5, limit of 0.42, and yet with the logarithmic one, it's 0.08. In other words, it's a dramatic difference, which means that it's a prior-dependent problem, which means that you'd better be very careful when you place a limit to say, this is what I have done. This has not been addressed because everybody does the canned uniform R thing. This is what the response is in CLTT for that. These are the WMAP results. There are error bars which are being suppressed out here. And this is the nature of the fits to the data. And so this is with the logarithmic prior, and this is with the uniform prior. This is not dealing with self-consistency, except for something which I won't talk about. And this is the level of gravity waves, which seen at the one sigma level, and so you can see that they're quite different. We will get that in a second. We're imposing monotonicity on this one, which is not self-consistency. I'm going to show you the results with.
No, only the monotonicity.
Inflation forces you to have.
That's correct, and that's what we'll see. And that's the thing that that's been the reason it's taken us so long to publish this. This is the response in the B power. Remember this low value is 0.05 microkelvin squared with the one sigma. And this with logarithmic prior. This is the sort of level of band for that thickness, what spider and Planck together you should be able to do on error bars. In other words, you could start to get those if you can control everything. Okay, but as I said, epsilon is the way to go, and that changes things. Because that enforces a relationship. Every time you do something on H, in order to deal with the scalar spectrum, you get an immediate response in the tensor spectrum. So the tendency to do the downturn, the observable range, by the way, the dominant observable range is here. Data really, really peters up there, so what's happening up here is not that relevant. But the thing that is totally amazing is that this is the uniform prior. You can get crossing of the tensor and the scalar spectrum, and it's a perfect agreement with the data. It's no problem. Okay, so scalar is still here. This is all being defined, most importantly, by the acoustic peak kind of information. So this is really nailed pretty well. The logarithmic prior gives you a much stronger constraint, amusingly enough. I don't know, we'll get into that. Okay. All fits. Oh, yes, okay. Right, and so things still fit, even with tiny values and with the somewhat higher values. And so it has quite a impact of which prior you use with this epsilon expansion. Okay, so now we're in a prior-dependent thing. Let's look to the long-term future, and this is long-term, perhaps 2017, of when something like a B-pole will go. So we put in a spectrum with a bit of running, uniform tensor and ACBAR parameters, the parameters we determine in the ACBAR paper. And this is the reconstruction of R compared to what was input. And using the uniform priors, you get this great agreement down to almost 10 to the minus 3. And using the logarithmic prior, you also get the great agreement. So in other words, what you put in is what you get out. And so that's really reassuring. It says that we can, in principle, pass through into an era in which priors are irrelevant. It will enforce, it'll say, here is your detection, and I don't care whether you assume that it's logarithmic prior or uniform prior. With Planck, it's not quite as good. In Spider, we could do a similar tale. Yes, you can get good reproduction down to the level in which you can achieve things, which is about, here's the 0.1 mark. And so Planck should be able to do the 0.1, maybe a bit better. We've been more optimistic in the past. Okay, and they all have impacts to what B would be. Okay, so it looks like I won't be really telling you about inflation now. So inflation then, here is the summary. Well, as you know, the basic six-parameter model with no gravity waves does reasonably well. The usual gravity wave limits come from adding R with a fixed gravity wave spectrum and no consistency criterion. That's the 0.28 number. But that depends upon relating the high K region to the low K region. And so once you break that, it means that there's more freedom to find R, so that the bounds become larger. And yeah, that depends upon the specific assumption you have for what the distribution of R is in a prior probability. So you can either get largish values, which is uniform prior, or smallish values, which is logarithmic prior. I already mentioned that B pole could break this prior dependence. I mentioned the stringy models that give infinitesimal values. And I think I want to end with this basic statement, that even with low energy inflation, the prospects are good with Spider and even Planck to either detect the gravity wave induced B1 polarization or set a bound which you don't get 10 to minus 10, but a bound which is sufficiently powerful that it will essentially rule out all of the models that have been discussed probably up until 2005 or so that seem to have an enforced R coming out that was in the regime of, let's say, greater than about 0.02. So that's a very positive thing. I mean, it's not as exciting if it's just an upper limit, but upper limits can be extremely important in their own right. And the other point is that all of these experiments are very strong Canadian rules. Okay, and I know you want to eat, which is right. Maybe I will just continue my summary for a second, which is the inflation now summary. So inflation now, our statement is that now you can only essentially determine one parameter, even when you, and I mentioned this at the beginning, even when you add a really brilliant future force, which will happen, which is Planck plus JDAM plus weak lensing from Dune or from a JDAM that also includes weak dome lensing, we will improve the limit on the overall slope of the potential. But what you can't do, and you can also determine when the Hubble drag ceases at some level, but what you don't get to do is to do a potential reconstruction. There just isn't enough information available, even with these fantastic experiments. So that's not the most positive conclusion, but nonetheless, as I said, it's totally worth doing. And so that's the point I'm going to end up.
Questions? Okay, if not, Justin wanted to, oh, sorry.
I guess I wanted, you know what, I'm going to wait until the paper comes out there, and then I'll ask.